I began integrating some more visceral, experiential, body-based somatic techniques in the way that I trained, in the way that we coached, in the way that we set up meeting structures and strategic brainstorming sessions and all these things. And I just saw this click.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio, a podcast that explores the intersection of leadership, culture, performance, and flow. Through thought-provoking conversations with innovative changemakers and industry leaders, we uncover the mindsets, strategy, and experiences that drive personal and professional excellence. Each episode offers real-world insight, inspiring stories, and actionable wisdom to help you cultivate resilience, purpose, and peak performance in your own life. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we are thrilled to welcome Marina Mayer, co-CEO and founder of Sway, a firm dedicated to building resilience in organizations with bodies in mind. With 18 years of experience in multidisciplinary environments, Marina is an organizational development and leadership psychologist, specializing in talent strategy, executive coaching, and scaling cohesive organizations. Her award-winning research, How Movement Moves Us, explores the untapped potential of the body in facilitating the cognitive, emotional, and social processes of leadership and high performance. Marina, it is so wonderful and a privilege to have you on Mindful Warrior Radio today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for bringing me on.
I am so fascinated with the topic that we are going to cover today. What inspired you and your time doing research on embodied movement and its connection to leadership development? What truly inspired you to go in that direction?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it drops really into my story. And hopefully this will resonate with people who have also had non-linear career stories. I started, as you know, in athletics with a background first as an athlete myself, and then second coaching for 10 years. So I worked with everything from three-year-olds up to teams with 18, 19-year-olds, a whole range of ages. And what I experienced in the context of athletics was that our bodies and our performance, our team cohesion, the way that we communicate, the way that we connect, these things are inextricably linked. And so when a team is not performing well, we don't sit around and talk about it for ages. What we do is we get back in the ring and we practice again and again. And then the cohesion that comes out of that is a natural byproduct of moving bodies together, of being in sync physically. And so these things were kind of largely intuitive to me. And then I moved into a corporate space, and a largely male-dominated corporate space, being the only female leader in that environment. And it was jarring, the disconnect that I experienced with bodies and the work that we're doing. And so what I saw was a lot of times just the completely ignoring of bodies. So for instance, someone becomes a leader and you say, you need to learn how to lead teams, you know, people who live and breathe in physical bodies and who are working on production floors or on oil rigs or doing physical work. And we would say, here's a book or here's a webinar on how to lead. Now go learn. But even more so than that, as a female leader, I noticed not only were kind of ignoring bodies, I noticed my instinct to try and kind of hide my body or make myself smaller in my female body to be taken seriously, to be seen as credible, or even to just be safe in certain environments. And so I found that disconnect really interesting. And then the third piece of my story is that I began doing therapy myself and EMDR. And EMDR is a body-based therapy that works on trauma by simulating eye movements or bilateral stimulation of the body that's similar to REM sleep. So it blocks the part of our brain, the fear center, that lizard brain, the amygdala, where a lot of our emotions come from, and allows us to get to deeper places to kind of rewire traumas. And that, for someone who was surprisingly in her head a lot with her own story, broke things loose for me in a way that was transformative. And so what I began doing in my work was getting curious about and coaching executives and working on larger systemic organizational transformation or trying to design learning and development programs, I began to think, how do we get the body involved? Because it was so transformative for me. It was so intuitive to my past in athletics. And so I began integrating some more visceral, experiential, body-based somatic techniques in the way that I trained, in the way that we coached, in the way that we set up meeting structures and strategic brainstorming sessions and all these things. And I just saw this click. And so when I landed into London School of Economics and we began talking about the ways that work was changing with COVID, with AI, with all the challenges that we're having in the workplace, I became really curious to see, like, how do we bring bodies into work more? And what could some really practical mechanisms for that be? And so that's how I started looking into embodiment and movement specifically as a mechanism of bringing your body into the leadership process.
As I said, it's so fascinating how all of your life experience has brought you kind of to this point of understanding the use of the body in the corporate world and in the face of leadership. And I think many of our leadership models are really focused on strategy and mindset. And many times the body is overlooked. Why do you think the body is usually overlooked in these settings?
Well, I think there's a lot of ways to come at this. I think if you look at it from a kind of anthropological or social science perspective, in the Western part of our world, there's a real trend towards kind of the rational mind being the peak version of human form. And that came into kind of our culture as a value, as a kind of frame of thinking. It's also seen as a very masculine form of thinking. And a lot of these spaces, leadership spaces, are very masculine, kind of dominated spaces in terms of the way that we create and share knowledge, the way that leadership is seen as credible. And so being directive, having the answers, being non-emotional and quote unquote objective, these are the things that we've valued in the way that we approach leading companies and building knowledge as a society. But what we see kind of biologically and physiologically is that the body is actually where all of this starts. So before our brain has a chance to form a thought or mount a behavioral response, all of the input is being coming into our bodies through our body's perceptions, neurons, going traveling up into the brain, hitting the emotional center first, and then the thinking center, and then coming out as behaviors and actions. And so, in order to create a true intervention and transformation, we can't split out two things that actually aren't separate. And I think that's just a slightly more balanced feminine masculine way of looking at leadership that includes into what we have traditionally thought of as like intuition and emotion, gut response, these things that are actually quite simply like neurologically and physiologically backed as forms of intelligence.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about the role of the body in leadership?
That we don't use it. I think it comes down to that. I think that we think that it's not playing a role just because it's dormant. And the truth is that our body is mounting a response to situations before and maybe without us even realizing it. And so you can know the right way to respond, but then when you react differently in the moment, that response is in your central nervous system. It's in your body. It's not in your head. And so connecting those two things and realizing that it is playing a role, even if you're not paying attention to it or not aware of it. And the second thing is I think it's just underutilized. And so when we sit at a computer all day and we don't engage the body, we're missing opportunities for enhancing our performance and enhancing our cognition and enhancing the way that we connect with people. Because it is connected to how we think and how we're able to problem solve and be creative or feel energized or have mental clarity. And so it's just a tool that's just kind of sitting dormant, even though it still is in our hand, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I think coming from a background of athletics like you and training 6.5 hours a day, 6 days a week at the highest level, and then moving into sitting at a computer for 8 hours a day. Talk about feeling underutilized. My body's like, I'm just hanging out here, you know? And we do our little things, you know, throughout our days to make us feel like we're still, within our bodies. But it is challenging when the work is is a lot of screen facing. Can you share a little bit about ways in which you are beginning to help people get embodied so that they have that ability to connect with others, that they can elevate their performance, that they have more clear minds as they go into their work days?
Yeah.
How do you develop that in others?
Well, I love the word develop that you use because I really think embodiment is a skill. And a lot of times, especially for high achievers, there's this real sense of like, tell me what to do so I can knock it out of the park. And we don't like being beginners when we're really high achievers. And even though we've lived in our bodies our whole lives, if we haven't developed that sense of connection and the word that describes it is called interoception, which is like the signals that come from the ground up, the sensations that the intelligence that's coming up into our brain. If we haven't really strengthened that awareness as a part of our practice, it just is going to take some time to understand. And for me, this is my journey has really started with there was a period of time when I had to actually sit there and close my eyes and put my hands on my body and say, what do I need right now? And just be quiet for a second. And then there was this little voice that would come up and say, drink some water, or stand up, or talk to somebody, or I need a hug, or I need a snack. And developing the connection to that voice just took some time. And I think in addition to just being a bit attentive to it and trying to give yourself time, there's also experimenting because not everything that works for me is going to work for you, Cami. Not everything that worked for you yesterday is going to work for you today. And so getting back into our play and to experimenting a little bit more and allowing ourselves to just have fun with paying attention to how things affect us. So, like if you play tennis in the morning before work and then you realize that your brain is super sharp, making a note of that and then trying. Okay, I've got a really important meeting next week. Maybe I'll go hit a ball against a wall a couple times before I go into that meeting and see how it helps me, see if it helps me tune up my performance. So I think just attentiveness and play are really the best place to start.
That's awesome. I think what's really interesting is this idea of some of us have not, had the opportunity or even the beginnings of becoming embodied. But I'm wondering, even too, have you found or experienced that we've actually trained our minds to disconnect from our bodies? Not only maybe we haven't had the opportunity to learn how to be embodied or connected to our bodies, but also to be able to endure or tolerate or get through or, even accomplish what needs to be accomplished. Have we even wired our brains as humans to turn off that connection to be able to accomplish what needs to be done?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, the first thing that I would say is in this way, we always need to go lightly because if we have shut down our connection to our bodies, there is a good reason that we've done that as a way to keep ourselves safe. And so, what you don't want to do is throw the doors open and go charging in and be really harsh with yourself in this area because it's probably a learned behavior. It probably was learned very, very young. And there was good reason at the time for that kind of coping mechanism of disconnection. Even if it's not serving you now, there's probably some things that live there that might need to be handled gently. So I would say just be gentle with yourself as you're exploring this. The second piece is that there's a real social element to why we do this, right? We are products of our the social or environments that we live in. When you are in a train station or on an escalator or walking into a movie theater, we know how to behave largely because of the social installations that we're a part of, the social norms. And so when we're in organizations where everyone sits at their desk and doesn't get up and talk with their hands and walk around mid-meeting or do walking meetings or bring their body to work in more visible ways, it's going to be a lot weirder and harder to do that, right? And so there's an element of having to bring some social normality to it and be able to have conversations or even just explicitly say to your team, hey, I want to try something out. I've noticed that we get super tired sitting and brainstorming for 2 hours straight. What if we took this problem out onto a racquetball court and talked it out? Or what if we did a walking meeting this week instead? Or I'm going to just put some like fidget toys around the table and some Play-Doh, and we're just going to, you can get up and stand up. How, if you need, you don't have to ask permission, just go get water. You can kind of create those social permissions and norms to allow people to begin to show up in that way. So I think there's a lot of reasons why we don't enter into kind of our bodies. And then I think the third thing that happens, Cami, a lot with athletes is that we've trained ourselves to shut off those signals because we had to get past limits of pain, to get past limits of, you know, to build that grit and that endurance. In a lot of ways, we actually had to disconnect from our bodies and really rely on our mental game. And so that reintegration can actually be quite hard, to know when to slow down and take a rest, or to listen to some of the other signals that are coming up. So, yeah, lots of reasons at play, and it's different for every person, of course, but nothing that can't be retrained.
It's interesting too, this idea of we've had to disconnect from our bodies to be able to pass certain thresholds of pain or discomfort. I'm curious of how the practice of embodiment in leadership in the face of very kind of high pressure, high intensity, high volume, in high cadence, even. How does that show up and play a role? How does this in this idea of embodiment and movement in the workplace allow for leaders to be able to look at a challenge or again, a really high stakes problem and be able to manage it better because of the relationship and or connection they have with their body?
It's a really good question. I think bodies come up in the language of companies now a lot in the space of wellness, and they should, right? So we should be talking about rest and breath work and mindfulness and yoga and these things, and offering permission for people to use their to kind of get back in their bodies as a way of balancing out stress and de-stressing at work. But we by only talking about bodies in the space of wellness, what we're basically saying is that you use your brain to perform and your body to unwind. And I think that's false. I think we can either try and perform by shutting down our bodies and ignoring what they need, or we can see our bodies as a partner in performance. And this switch has happened in sports over the last 30 years, where people have realized that the mental side of game of the game is just as important as the physical side. In fact, studies show that some of the top percentage of tennis players in the world, the real difference is what they say to themselves in their head after they've missed a shot. And that differentiates the greatest of all time from those that are just below that. And so we know that mental aspects of the game play a big role in the physical side for sports. I think the same is really true in the corporate environment, where the being in our bodies is actually the thing that can take us to the next level in terms of performance, not just wellness. But we have to see our bodies as partners in that way and treat them with the respect of not just running them into the ground. There'll be moments where we have to push ourselves physically, work long hours, grind, and things like that. But inviting the body to the table as a tool for performance as well in the workplace is a really good place to start.
What is some data or information that you have been able to discover around the impact of the body and performance in the workplace?
A good question. And there's so much insight that we can get from neuroscience on this. And there is a neuroscientist turned executive coach, Tara Swart, who does some really good work on this. And she talks about how the role of stress in for leaders with their teams. And she has this punchline, which is you know, I think controversial on purpose, but she says, to leaders, like, you're making your teams fat. And what she's saying is that cortisol is actually contagious. And not really contagious in the sense that we spread it from one to another, but our bodies, even if the leader is containing the stress well, when somebody is in a position of power, specifically in the herd, and their cortisol levels are high, it's an evolutionary survival response for the rest of the kind of the social group's cortisols to spike. And the problem is if you're in a perpetual state of stress, what you're going to do is cause everybody else's cortisol on your team to strike, to spike. And in that survival state, we actually don't have access to our kind of fully evolved brains. We're in our lizard or our fish brain. So we're in that fight, flight, or freeze response where we don't have access to social connection and cohesion, complex problem solving, creative thinking, all the things that have come in kind of our fully evolved status require us to be in what polyvagal theory considers that kind of zone of tolerance, that middle state where you're alert, you're open, you're sharp, but you're not in manic or you're not shut down. And so being in that middle state yourself as a leader, finding ways back to regulation amidst all the stress, not only gives you access to your full brain, but it also allows your team to operate in that state of flow and productivity without getting into a state of manic or shutdown. And there are moments where we have to rev, right? Like our bodies do this for a reason. If someone slams on their brakes in front of you, you need that cortisol spike to survive because you have to react quickly. But you're not going to be able to solve complex organizational problems or navigate a volatile economic environment for over the course of 2 years in a state of constant fight or flight. You're going to need problem solving. You're going to need social cohesion and connection, and ability to build relationships. And so that would be my biggest advice, is that finding ways to regulate yourself so that you can be at your peak performance has social impact on your teams as well.
Yeah, I mean, just the information that you're sharing around a regulated nervous system so that you can access just your full
Best self.
complexity. Yeah, complexity of your brain and your best self. And I think what's interesting about what I'm hearing you say is that there are moments and times when we need to rev. I'm curious of, is there, how does healthy stress or a certain level of stress positive to the body, and when is it beyond, and how do you play with that in your embodiment work?
That's such a good question because, again, kind of going back to some of the wellness trends, stress is really demonized as like damaging, right? And to live in a perpetual state of stress is not healthy for us, right? The reason why Tara Swartz talks about cortisol in that way, in that kind of controversial way, is because cortisol actually does cause the survival response that causes us to kind of gain weight around the midsection, and it throws us physiologically into a state that's survival based but not good for our longevity. And so there are real health consequences to that. But I think what's really interesting around this is there's some studies and some theories around stress is enhancing versus stress is damaging. And what these show, they took a group of middle school type age kids. They did a one-time training where they help them frame up the idea of stress in their mind as something that will help them grow, that it will be enhancing to them. And they gave them a framework for thinking of stress as something that will stretch them. So I'll give you an example. You're about to head into a review session, post-action review on a project that you've done. You know that you're going to receive feedback from your boss and maybe a couple other key stakeholders. And you feel a little bit of stress about it, right? There's some social threat. And there's two ways to look at this. There's a way of to be afraid because you think that you're not going to have the resources to handle whatever they say to you. So your body mounts this, I'm about to experience injury or damage response, right? We can't really differentiate physical and social threat from one another physiologically. So you're thinking damage is coming and you're bracing. The second way to think about it is, I'm going to hear some things that might be kind of hard to hear, but ultimately they're going to help me grow, right? Now, you may have a little bit of adrenaline heading into both of those ways of thinking about the stress, but it's hard to differentiate kind of like, the quantitative data from it, but qualitatively they're going to feel quite differently to you, right? And the difference is if you see stress as enhancing, when you go into that, not only will you adopt a growth mindset, you actually will grow and you will perform better over time. So those middle schoolers that received that training statistically performed far better than their peers 4 years down the line on standardized testing, which is just wild that one intervention could have such a huge quantitative, measurable impact on the way that these kids performed. And so it goes to show that there is a difference in terms of how we think of stress and how we have a relationship with stress. And what I find to be most helpful about that is to try and create that pause moment in between the stressor and the stress response. So what we think of stress as all as one. Stressor and stress response is one thing. I'm stressed. That means there's something that's stressing me out and I'm stressed. But if we peel those two things apart, we see what the stressor is and we have a moment to say, okay, this is going to be challenging, but I think I have the resources to handle it. It's going to help me grow. Or, you know what? I don't have the resources to handle it. I need to call in the community support here, right? You give yourself that break. Now your stress response gives you an opportunity to say, is this really a slam on the brakes to save my life moment, right? Sometimes we don't quite have that type of gap. Or is this just feedback from my boss? Is this just a tough problem that we're trying to solve? And how do I mount resources to meet the moment? And I think that really, that pause can make all the difference if we're afforded the time to do that.
Amazing. And I think when you're talking about this pause and deciding as the individual, do I have the resources or do I need to call in community support? In that pause, with the work that you're doing, what physical component would you put in that pause? Because that pause that you reflected on is still, okay, let me assess, let me kind of
Actually
put my
stop.
head on a swivel. What would you add to that? In the physical sense.
That's such a great question. I think there's a lot of tools that are available to us, and I like to categorize them in a couple ways. One is movement, right? So taking a break, going for a walk, take a lap, right? Walking helps kind of calm down the emotions because it simulates that left, right, bilateral stuff that we were talking about. So it blocks the fear center of the brain. So any type of movement, if you're sitting at your desk and you can't go for a walk, you're in the middle of a meeting and you're having a stress response, you can tap your legs with your hands, left, right, left, right, right? You can tap your feet, left, right. You could press your fingernails into your other finger, left, right, right? You stimulate that left, right response. So even if you can't actually physically move, creating some type of physical movement, connection with the brain from left to right, super helpful. So that's the first one. The second one is breath work. We've got movement, we've got breath work. Breathing helps regulate our physiological response. Again, gets us out, returns us to regulation, gets us out of that physical flight fight response. So if you're feeling stuck, if you can't mobilize, you're like in a doom scrolling, you're numbing through eating, you're probably in a freeze response. Gentle inhale focused breathing could be really helpful for you. So just inhale for 6 seconds, hold, exhale for two. Inhale for six, hold, exhale for two. Inhale will wake you up. If you're in the opposite place, you feel jittery, you feel manic, you feel rushed, you don't have enough time. One of my favorite tools, Huberman talks about this a lot, the physiological or psychological sigh. Inhale, hold, inhale again. And then long exhale. So it's kind of like a child that's having a tantrum, right? Or the dog does that before they fall asleep. You've heard them do that, like inhale, exhale. That is just an attempt to regulate and calm down. And so we can use breath work to help us get back to center. So we've got movement, we've got breath work. My third favorite is sensory experience. And using our senses to bring us back into our body is incredibly helpful. I'll give you an example. I had a leader that I was coaching. She was going through interviewing processes. She worked in management consulting, Deloitte, KPMG, big companies, very, very good at what she does. And she just hated interviews, specifically case studies. And she went into every interview, they'd give her a case study where she'd have to solve it live and she'd go blank. And she couldn't figure out why. She's super smart, had done loads of therapy, couldn't figure out her way around this. And so this is what I told her on the next one. I want you to get a very tart iced, like lime iced tea. And I want you to bring it in a cold lime tart iced tea, hold it in your hands. And every single time they ask you a question and you feel yourself starting to go blank or go elsewhere, I want you to take a little sip. And she told me after that interview where she had the iced tea with her that she was able to access her brain and perform in a way that she hadn't been able to do because every time she started to go out of her body, she used her senses to pull her back in and help her regulate her in the present moment. And I think sensory experience can do this for us a lot. We can listen to bird song that signals safety. We can hold a warm cup of coffee in our hands and smell it. We can feel something beneath our toes. We can do kind of check all of our five senses. We can take a warm bubble bath. We can feel the breeze on our face. And so I often have my leaders just log what are the sensory experiences that make you feel connected, energized, open, alert, capable, good in your own skin. And then they log those things that impact them, and then they just find ways to integrate them in their days. Yeah, so movement, breath work, sensory experience. Those are my three categories that I pull on often.
Fantastic. And the examples that you're providing are they're in the some of them that you provided are in the moment, right? So it's not like the example of the woman who went blank when she was doing the case studies in the interview process. It's not like she could go take a walk, take a lap, go for a run, go hit
Hold
a
on, I'm gonna go do an hour-long spin class. Hold that thought. Right. Yeah, it's the
Exactly.
in the moment interventions. And I think this is often a barrier to embodiment in the workplace, is especially for women. Let's get really practical. I don't have time on my lunch break to go do an hour-long workout, shower, re-blow dry my hair, put on makeup, and get back to the office. Some guys can maybe pull that off, especially, if they're just slapping on some deodorant and they don't even have hair to dry. But for many women with the social norms, we can't show up with a like we've just come out of a shower into a meeting and appear as professional. It's very rushed. And so we need more practical ways to make our bodies accessible in the workspace, in the workday, in the rhythms that we're in.
That's fantastic. And I think the range of like what are you able to do in the moment when you're under fire, when you
Yes.
have that moment for that pause in which you're talking about, and then when you have a little bit more of space. And then the idea of having organizations and systems start to normalize what is a walking meeting, what is it to take a meeting out on the racquetball court and hit balls while you're discussing where this potentially could go. What is it
Yeah.
to normalize? Hey, go get a coffee, go for a walk, and then come back in. We'll start the meeting after that. And so there's these kind of different levels of accountability and responsibility for self and even for others in that leadership role to start incorporating and
Yeah.
bringing the body online.
Yeah. Yeah. And modeling that to your point. Yeah. And I think what's interesting about this too is that we're not going to get it totally right. And so opening dialogue. So for leaders, especially male leaders, because this is often seen as a more feminine form of intelligence, is that kind of gut feeling and thing. But you see very experienced leaders in very masculine environments often very much rely on gut feel, and being able to open dialogue about where that gut feel is coming from and examine it for bias, right? Because we know that gut can often include pattern recognition that's based on maybe false information or bias or fear, right? But beginning to create dialogue around these types of forms of intelligence and ways of working to find ways that work for the team as well, that will also help normalize and discover together how do we make ourselves a bit more embodied in the workspace here, right? In a culture that works for us in this team, in this room.
I'm curious of how this has been received with the organizations that you've been working with, and just the challenge and or success in introducing this to leaders and organizations.
A really great question. One of the synergies that I wasn't fully expecting, my background is in a lot of blue collar environments, industrial kind of manufacturing service, and which means that there's a lot of technical training. So I would build technical training around chemistry, metallurgy, safety, those types of things, industrial flushing. And I have found such synergy in the blue collar safety spaces because they understand how important bodies are for work. And also, the training is so visceral, right? If you think about the ways that pilots, firefighters, these people who are in where physical safety, medical doctors, everything about their training includes visceral, experiential, immersive training, right? Doctors are working in cadaver labs, they're doing residencies, pilots are in simulators. And so when you begin to use these analogies for how can we create the flight simulator for leadership, how can we create flight simulators for resilience in sales, you can begin to transfer these things in, but it just takes a little bit of a step of analogy. to get it into the environments that are a bit more cognitively dominated than the physical ones. And I will say, I've been pleasantly surprised by how receptive people are to this. And yeah, I think translation is just rooting it in people's experience and letting them be their kind of chief, the chief curiosity officer about this in their own, how they're going to implement it is a really nice way in. Because you can start with what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and then let's workshop that.
Absolutely. Do you have a maybe an example or a story of either this movement, breath, or senses that you have worked with an individual with that really kind of surprised you or moved you, or an example of someone integrating it and having success?
Gosh, that's a really good question. And there's a lot of there's sorry, there's a lot of instances that are flowing around in my head, but I think what I'll draw from is from the actual research study that I did. So the way that I designed the research when I was at London School of Economics was I wanted to study the integration of movement and leadership processes. And the hard thing about that is that the workplace treats these things as very separate. So even the organizations that offer yoga classes at lunch aren't doing that in the form of trying to train leadership competencies and frameworks through movement and in hand with movement. And so what I did was I built a case study. So I created a leadership workshop that integrated movement, breath work, somatic experience, and sensory experience into the actual folds of the agenda. So kind of a traditional executive female leadership workshop with movement and breath work in. And then I interviewed the participants on the backside of that experience after they'd had time to experience it and let it land in their work, back into their work environment to understand the impact. And I think what was really surprising to me was a lot of these women who were, some of them very experienced female leaders. I mean, speaking at Davos, like really incredibly experienced women, some of them multiple masters, MBAs. They've been in a million of these rooms. Some of them were organizational psychologists themselves, so they understood these like leadership connection and the psychology that we were going through. They'd done it a million times, a lot of these exercises. So there was nothing really revolutionary about the content itself or about being in a room with 15 other incredible women, right? So both of those things were pretty normal for them. But what they reported to me in terms of their level of their own kind of internal experience and ability to connect and overcome some of the internal barriers that they had and had breakthroughs through the movement in that environment was pretty astonishing. I'll give you a couple examples. One of the women had a particular pattern that she knew about. She knew it inside and out. She knew she would do this thing that was kind of self-sabotage-y, and she couldn't figure out why she couldn't change it. And in the middle of one of the movement sequences, there a word started kind of coming up in her body as she was moving through and just kind of thinking about this block. And she had an aha moment about what was happening for her. And from that moment on, experienced complete transformation in this area. As soon as that aha came through, she was able to connect the dots and change her behaviors there moving forward. And then another woman had said to me that she had been in these rooms for ages and always really had trouble. She felt this kind of internal effort to like overcome and connect with other women in these environments, that it would take time. It would just like, but she felt shocked by her level of authenticity and the level of connections that were formed almost instantly because of the movement sequences. And she really attributed it to that movement. And then the last piece was that a lot of the women reported feeling very constricted, and they would kind of talk, they would put their bodies in a box. So for those of you who can't see what I'm doing, that you're just listening to the audio, I'm like actually physically shrugging my shoulders and crossing my arms across my chest and hunching over. And they would do this motion where they would talk about how they would have to contort themselves and make themselves smaller to fit into kind of the institutional norms of leadership, or they would feel huge imposter syndrome because they didn't fit what was the picture of leadership. And one of the most surprising findings for me was that movement offered the sense of full emancipation. And they actually said, I feel like I'm taking up more space. I feel bigger. I feel taller. And they would open their chest and like lift through the top of the head. And they said, I feel like free and like I can take up more space and like I belong here. And so those elements, which relate the personal to kind of the large institutional or power dynamics, I was just shocked. I had no idea it would have that effect. And I think that's where the power is in this type of thing, is when you begin to bring movement into the dynamic at work, you get access to the full potential of people individually, socially, politically, from a power perspective. I don't mean like, ideologically, politically, I mean actually power dynamics. And you can begin to transform talent because they're able to show up in their full selves. And so, yeah, that was just such a privilege and so shocking to see how effective that was.
Now, the power of bringing the whole self online, the authentic self online, and what it can do to your leadership and your performance is quite phenomenal, especially in those examples that you just provided. Last thing I want to ask you before we wrap up here, what is one thing all of our listeners can bring into the office tomorrow, with them based off of all of the wonderful information you've shared with us today?
That's a great question. My favorite thing to do is to create, take a piece of paper and just put a line down the middle. And on the left side, to write like connected, energized, flowing, confident in my own skin, whatever adjectives you want to feel more of, or you need to perform. And then on the right side, put, frustrated, exhausted, whatever those things are that you're showing up that you want to kind of minimize more. And just start to take note of what you were doing that day or in that thing that led into that moment. And be specific about the sensory experience, about, were you sitting down? Were you in a room full of conflict? Like, include all the social, physical, environmental, sensory dynamics. And then just begin to notice. Begin to notice what supports you in your embodiment and what pulls away. And try and connect the dots when you know that you're heading into a meeting where there's going to be a lot of conflict, we're going to be sitting for 4 hours. Say that's one of the things that shows up on kind of your negative list. Pull something from the positive list over and see what you can integrate to support yourself through that and help balance. And I think just starting from that place of observation is really powerful.
Incredible. Marina, thank you so much for your time and your insight. It has been an absolute pleasure.
It's been such a joy. Thank you so much, Cami.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend, follow Mindful Warrior Radio, and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior and check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.